Daniel Ellsberg. It's an honor to see you again.
Too loud? No, listen, the problem with the lights, I was laughing because it reminds me of the single most embarrassing moment of my public life that I can remember, which I will share with you. I don't think I've ever mentioned it to anyone before. My wife is the only other person who experienced this with me. I was soon, when I had just gotten on trial, or in the fall of 1971, somebody did a documentary on me, which was to be shown in Cambridge, where I was living there. And at some theater, and I was asked to speak afterwards. And I was a little embarrassed by the documentary because of the interviews with me and so forth, but it was quite adulatory and had some very romantic pictures of me and my wife walking on Walden Pond, not a fact, which is nice, but it was kind of a little dramatic. And so when that ended, it was, the lights were just like this, which is, they were shining right in our eyes, and couldn't see the audience at all. You're invisible out there. It could just be a laugh track out there. So it's like being president. We're in a bubble here. We don't even, can't even see the people out there. Exactly. So I felt that wasn't good, and I wanted the house lights to be put on, which I was asking here. I don't know what the problem is. I know it's a movie theater, but there must be house lights. And so I looked up at the people, the technicians who had the lights up there, and it was going like this. And the audience raggedly and bit by bit began to stand up under the impression I was asking for a standing ovation. They had not given me spontaneously, actually. It was quite embarrassing. But anyway, so it goes. If you read the paper this morning, you will have seen pictures in the San Francisco Chronicle of the president giving a back massage to Angela Merkel and didn't seem to like it. And there's a number of columns by Mark Morford and others, and even on the front page, saying how embarrassing a president is, how sophomoric, what a frat boy he still is, and humiliates us and so forth. The problem we're facing here, and the reason for impeaching this president, is not that he's embarrassing. It's that he's dangerous. I don't think he is a fool. He has some, this is not a joke, he has some kind of a reading problem, which proves nothing about his intelligence. Everybody who sees him says he's not a fool. I can believe that, as a matter of fact. But I say the problem is not that he's a fool. The problem is that he's dangerous. He's dangerous to the security of this country and the world, and he's dangerous to our democracy. Dangerous to our democracy. The passage you were reading from Julius Caesar was about a man who would be king, who would be emperor, who eventually would be God. Upon what meat hath this our Caesar fed? They regarded him as dangerous to the republic, and they assassinated him. Now, neither impeachment nor even not even mention the other word would protect us from the dangers we are facing right now. And even getting rid of Bush by impeachment or by other means would not protect us. After all, we have now no longer in the government. We don't have Wolfowitz, he's sloughed off, Pearl, Fife. They've Ashcroft, they've all gone, and what difference has it made? When it comes to people of really bad judgment, this team has depth. And of course, it's not quite, we don't have to worry about impeaching Bush, and then we'll be Chuck with Cheney. I'll come to that in a moment. We're quite a ways from impeaching Bush. What I'm talking tonight about, and the reason I'm here is because I think it is essential, to have be part of a movement and to be pressing for the impeachment of Bush, for us as a people, for us to be demanding that our Congress define the actions of this administration and this president as impeachable as high crimes and misdemeanors, defining that, whether we can get a majority of the House, Republican or Democrat, to agree to that or not, it's essential. Because nothing could be clearer than that this president, in full public view, is in fact not just violating the law. Presidents do that, all presidents do that. Not just that he's been caught, but he's declaring quite openly he's above the law. That's the clear and explicit meaning of statement after statement that he makes and that his lawyers make for him, that no law applies to him. He believes himself to have the powers of a king, at least while we're at war, and he has declared an endless war. He didn't get that idea by himself. He has relied on the statements of four or five lawyers, several of whom he has regarded as fit for higher office, and the Senate has confirmed them, basically. But if you read Jane Mayer's excellent piece a few weeks ago, in the New Yorker, on David Addington, who is now the chief of staff of Vice President Cheney, a lawyer who replaced Libby when Libby was indicted, who has been with Cheney for a very long time, since he was in the Congress, if not before that, but I think it was in Congress where he first worked for Cheney. And in fact, maybe you'll remember, but I think that Addington was the person who wrote for him a dissenting opinion on impeachment. Am I not right on that one? On Watergate? There was he wrote a famous dissenting opinion.
I don't know.
We'll go into that. But anyway, the point is on the article that Addington has sold him as a lawyer on this clear point of view, which was also shared by John Yoo, Y-O-O, by Bybee, now made a federal judge, by Gonzalez, who at that time was counsel to the president, having worked for him in Texas, written for him the recommendations for the death penalty over and over again in Texas, and is now, after it is revealed that he was the author of many of the legal opinions that led to the torture, the rendition, the wiretaps, all of these unconstitutional and illegal actions. Gonzalez is the Attorney General, as we know. And until these revelations came out, by leaks in every case, it's the only way we know those legal opinions. Until then, he was a leading candidate for Bush to put on the Supreme Court. Alito was an early designer of this point of view of the presidency, which Yoo has written a whole book about in his current capacity as professor at law school in Berkeley. Now, the shocking thing is not so much that he went back to a judge, to a professorship at Berkeley, but that he is bizarre and essentially authoritarian. I could say fascist, people say. Nazi, well, yes, Nazi, but also Italian, Japanese, Franco, not just the Germans, Nazis were had this point of view. A point of view of executive power, which is variously referred to as unitary executive, or another reference to the inherent powers of a president in wartime, inherent powers that the Congress cannot touch, that the Congress, which are the powers to do anything, really anything. Is a guy who's willing to carry the logic of that to any extreme you want to challenge him to. When he was asked by, I believe, a Notre Dame law professor on a program, do you believe that the president has the power to order that the child of a suspect be tortured? I think he may have been so specific as to say to have the testicles crushed of a boy in front of his parents to compel it. But in any case, he said tortured. You said that I would want to know why the president felt that was necessary. In other words, were his reasons for finding it necessary, adequate to satisfy me? If there's something that would not satisfy you is necessary. He's never said what it would be. As I say, what is shocking is I'm not aware of a single law professor at Bolton who has risen publicly to challenge you to that, these positions, to challenge those, to write law review articles saying this is a point of view that is the legal underpinning of fascism. As a matter of fact, a number of these people, as you can find, by the way, if you look it up on Google or something, are actual fans of a law professor and juris scholar named Carl Schmitt, who was, in fact, the lead. He was, by the way, a teacher of Leo Strauss. I think it was Schmitt who helped Strauss get into this country. Again, Strauss, of course, the guru of a lot of the neocons. But Schmitt was the leading jurist of the Nazi regime before that. And his views on the powers of the executive are, I believe, admired by most of the people who are advising the president here now. Biden, as I said, is another one here in the Justice Department who is now the a judge on an appellate court. One more, William Haynes, wrote opinions on this. Forget what his job was at the time. He was in the Army Department, I believe. Anyway, he's up for a high legal position now, of course. All of these people got through confirmation, that is the ones who, Alito and Roberts, who's another one who shares these views, of the absolute powers of the executive, now on the Supreme Court, both got confirmed without being pressed on the implications of this view of theirs on the inherent presidential powers, the king-like powers. The administration has role, one of Rule's lines is that the Democrats are in a pre-9/11 mentality. And someone, I think it was Feingold, who said, well, these people are in a pre-1776 mentality. But I'm not sure George III could have gotten away with all the things that this guy is doing. There was, after all, a parliamentary monarchy to a considerable extent. He was subject to the Parliament's judgments on budget to some extent. Granted, there are a lot of rotten boroughs, and our main complaint was that the court of King George III, our main complaint about Parliament, was the undue influence, the corrupt influence that the court had over Parliament, and essentially then a unit, an executive that ran without an independent branch in controlling it. I have a feeling that in some respects they have a pre-Magna Carta mentality. When it comes to habeas corpus, that's after Magna Carta. But what is it, about 10th or 12th century? Yeah, right. Yes, right. Well, they really go back for their traditions. And it is not the tradition of this country that started in 1776. Now, to say that these people are usurping power, that they are abusing power, that they have, in effect, run a kind of coup right now, is to be called by them a traitor. And not only by Ann Coulter, that's almost a compliment. If you're not called a traitor by Ann Coulter, it's like not being on Nixon's enemies list. Who am I? But traitor by the president and the vice president use these terms. You are giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Those are the words of the treason, the definition of treason. And they use them, of course, they use it about Tom Daschle, who made the Senate majority leader, I guess, at that time. And he was giving aid and comfort to the enemy. He was defeated. If you're not willing to be called traitor, if you're not willing to, by these people, if you're not willing to be called unmanly or weak or unpatriotic or un-American, you cannot say what needs to be said about what is going on in the White House and in Washington right now. You have to be willing to face up to that kind of size and something that goes away. Frankly, it's not easy to get used to that. I could say I have, finally. I've heard it so much in the last 35 years. But it's hard at first. People don't like that. Barbara Lee, for example, had the courage to be the one person. She was willing to say, as Senator Morse had said almost 30 years earlier, that or more, that in the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, to say that for the Congress to vote in favor of the war against Afghanistan after 9/11, without hearings, without debate, without participating in the process, was unconstitutional and was wrong. And she knew she would be called names for that traitor. I just read the other day she had to have a police guard at some point for the death threat she got. She is an example of what we need very much and what we have very little of in Congress. As I say, Michael Hayden, the general who was carried out these illegal warrantless wiretapping programs for the president as head of the National Security Agency. A program which I've been told by someone just from NSA, Russell Tice, who's a whistleblower who's trying to be heard now in Congress, he told me there were thousands of people in NSA who understood that this program was totally illegal, went against everything they'd been told was within the NSA charter. They were anguished about it. Some of them leaked about it, to their credit. But anyway, here you have Hayden going along and doing this, whether reluctantly or enthusiastically, for which he should have been court-martialed. Instead of even being given a Medal of Freedom yet, I guess that lies ahead, he is made by the President head of the Central Intelligence Agency instead of being court-martialed. Obviously a man who will do anything for the President. What that is to say is that these people are really not only doing everything they can quite openly to roll back the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the Great Society, all of the social democratic welfare provisions, rights that have been won over the last 60, 70 years, which is fairly open on their part. They are in the process of rolling back freedoms that are more than 200 years old in this country and changing our form of government. If we go along with, let's say, the Democrats in Congress who say, oh, we can't talk impeachment. First of all, we're a minority, so we can't vote it by ourselves. Well, that's true. It's true that Lyndon Johnson, who committed just as many impeachable offenses as Nixon and did, and as Bush has done. I would say that nothing that Bush has done so far is actually without precedent, and without precedent by Democrats as well as Republicans. Johnson, for example, had NSA listening to millions of Americans, including every anti-war leader. He also was his wiretapping every move that Martin Luther King made, with the approval or the signing on of Robert Kennedy at that time, Attorney General. The difference here is that it's hard to imagine Johnson being caught at that, which he wasn't, and then saying, yeah, I'm doing it, and I'm going to keep doing it. That's my power, and love it. And it's a little hard to imagine, but that was a different era. That was an era of democratic control, and not just these Democrats, but Democrats far to the left are more liberal than these are now. As a matter of fact, I think people pointed out that Nixon's domestic programs were far to the left of those of Bill Clinton in many areas, given the fact that he had a Democratic Congress in a very different mood. But to say that he had a Democratic Congress means that there really was very little chance that Lyndon Johnson would have been impeached by that Democratic Congress if he had been caught out, having lied us into war as egregiously as we were lied into this war. He wasn't caught in time. But had he been, is it realistic that a Democratic Congress would have really found him guilty of that high crime? I'm afraid not. What about the NSA that he was using? The FBI, the CIA, in an operation called Chaos, very nicely named, was spying on Americans. The Army intelligence, on the whole, as a whole mass of Army intelligence, was operating as secret police, as a political police, infiltrating meetings like this, and let's be I'll be very open here now, not to scare you, I'm defining where we are now. The chance that there are not government representatives in here now recording this program is negligible. It's not worth considering. So I say to them, you are acting as secret police in the United States of America, political police, working on political dissent, defining as treason the criticism, and you should reconsider what you're doing. You should tell your wives or your husbands and your children what you've been doing and get their opinion of it. Actually, that'd be good. Anyway, when we heard earlier if we don't impeach or something, there's no hope. I think one woman said that on the program. If we have to live with him, I'm afraid we have to deal with more hope than that. I live on a thin diet of hope, fortunately, a little more than that. But it is true, the idea of 3 more years of Bush is intolerable. Intolerable. I would say it is very hard to imagine Nixon having been impeached with all the evidence against him by Republican Congress. Republicans did vote for the Articles of Impeachment, but they were a minority in Congress, and it was hard to get them, and you couldn't get the Republicans to go along with impeachment for a war we'd been lied into, which was Cambodia. For the Cambodian bombing had to be removed, despite all the lying and the secrecy of it, from the Articles of Impeachment before the committee would vote for them. So a lot of things have to happen here. You will not get an impeachment, and I would desperately like to see an impeachment, not, of course, just of Bush, but of Cheney, Rumsfeld, of all the people, including the President of the United States. I've gone longer than you said, but not as long as Bill yet, so I'll try to be a little shorter than that, and then just parameters here. It reminds me, for example, that I was just thinking out here something that I really don't remember much these days, you might think I would, that it was crimes against me personally ordered in the White House. There were important parts of 2 of the 3 articles of impeachment of Richard Nixon. His sending in the White House CIA assets, human emigres and CIA assets, into my former psychoanalyst office to get information with which to blackmail me. There was a factor in that. He's not upholding the law, clearly violating the law. That, by the way, would not be so clearly illegal under the Patriot Act. That's how far we've moved here. Voted for by every Democrat in the Senate except one, Feingold, who acted like a leader in that respect. Okay. How about wiretaps? FBI testified in my court case, which lasted almost 2 years, over and over in the court, that I had not been overheard electronically. There was no evidence of it. I have on warrantless wiretaps ordered by President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, carried out by the FBI, kept out of the FBI files, booking procedures, because J. Edgar Hoover knew that they were illegal and he wanted that evidence for blackmail against the White House, particularly. So the evidence was stolen out of J. Edgar Hoover's safe by his number 2, who wanted to ingratiate himself with Nixon, and moved over to the White House. That was a factor in ending my trial. But more significantly, there was an illegal warrantless wiretap, which did figure in the impeachment of the president, which did happen, unforeseeably, but with a lot of unusual conditions. A special prosecutor under a law that no longer exists, unfortunately, much freer than Patrick Fitzgerald in his powers, an opposition party. There will not be an impeachment, I would have to predict, unless there is a Democratic House, and there will not be a conviction without a Democratic Senate, despite how fast this is. It is essential to get a Democratic House for a number of reasons, but not sufficient. Not sufficient. can we count on these Democrats, the incumbents, of getting reelected, pressing impeachment, providing that a precedent again for us? Hardly, hardly. These are the same Democrats who just voted confirmation of Michael Hayden and of Alito and of Robbins without even pressing them on these issues. Anybody, any Jew like myself, who is extremely critical of Israel, as I am, what amounts to aggressive war, I would say, by Israel, with the excuse of an irresponsible action by Hezbollah, I would say. But in any case, setting the Middle East on flank, anybody, I will be called for that by various people, not the same people who call me a traitor. Others will call me a self-hating Jew. Well, I brushed that one off. That's ridiculous. But if I were to be called a self-hating Democrat, I would find that harder to refute. But that's what we've got. That's what we've got. And here's what then I'll close with this. It is essential. To press for impeachment is essential. To fail to do that is to be complicit in a change in government in our country, which is in process, which in many respects has already taken place, which our president is increasingly openly proclaiming, a monarchical president with absolute power right now, who bypasses Congress deliberately, even when perhaps he doesn't have to, when he could easily get Congress to agree to what he wants, that he wants to make the point that he is not in any way beholden or restrained by Congress or the Constitution or international law or anything else. We have to say, no, that is not the presidency we want, that we demand. It's not what we aspire to. We've had it in secret at various times in the past when we didn't know it so much. But when we know it, we must define it as criminal and unconstitutional and unacceptable. The list of abuses by King George III that are listed in the Declaration of Independence have nothing on the list that can be made against this president right now. And that was proclaimed out of respect for the decent opinions of mankind as the reason for our revolution, for declaring independence. Now, we got that independence only by a war. And we can't get back the Bill of Rights by an armed revolution in this country. It is my strong belief that acts of terrorism or violence of any kind, such as a few minority people did in Vietnam, helped Nixon prolong the war, helped justify repressive measures with the will of the majority of the people, and that would be true today. I believe that acts of violence right now would have that same effect of legitimating the repression that has already taken place, and which I believe is going to get enormously greater with one more 9/11, or with a war against Iran toward which we are rushing at this moment. And in that war, I believe we will see it will be too late, in effect. It's now we have to act the freedoms we still do have and use them to keep them. The fact is that the Declaration of Independence led to a process, and not right away either, that gave us institutions that allow us non-violently to change abusive leaders and power. Voting is one of those, and it's essential. Campaigns are essential. Lobbying is essential. Letter writing, all these things are essential. Right now, a move to impeachment is one measure that has to be done. Non-violent civil disobedience, fasting, of which I personally am taking part in all of these things, not because I think that any one of them has any high promise, but I'm saying we are in a crisis right now, a constitutional crisis, and a crisis of security. The world will become much more dangerous for the United States, has already done so, of course, because of the Iraq invasion, and will probably never get back, not in my lifetime, not for generations, in terms of our security in the world as a result of that recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda. But an attack on Iran, which we are being led to right now, this week, will intensify that enormously. So our security is at stake, as well as our constitutional order. Every nonviolent, truthful thing that means that was used to end the Vietnam War and more than was ever done. Beginnings of a general strike were made in 1969 in a movement called the Moratorium that was crucial in preventing the use of nuclear weapons by Nixon in the fall of 1969, although we didn't know that. It's important to know that because we're facing the possible first use of nuclear weapons in an escalated war back and forth in the Middle East within months, in my opinion. In fact, I expect before the election, the way things are going right now. I think under this administration, I believe they have encouraged Israel to take, quote, disproportionate acts, that is, acts of war, major war, not only in Gaza, but in Lebanon now, in order to inspire intervention by Iran and Syria, which will justify war against Iran, by Israel, and by us. And although it seems that the objections of the Joint Chiefs of Staff themselves, according to Cy Hirsch, have ruled out the initial use of nuclear weapons, which the administration was insisting on as an option. And that option has allegedly been taken off the table. But in the case of a war in which Israel, for its, quote, self-defense, in the words of the president, bizarre words, in self-defense, attacks Iran at this point, and Iran reacts against Israel and our troops in Iraq and our shipping in the Gulf, a process of conflict will go on in which I would think the odds are not certain, but 6-5, 7-5, that we will use nuclear weapons against their underground nuclear facilities of any kind. So the crisis could not be greater. I come back. Every nonviolent, every truthful means, and by the way, although this book, I was just checking it, appears to me to be very accurate from what I can see, the movie has to change because statements by Ratner about Article 2 are mistaken. The statements that the president knew he was lying when he talked about aluminum tubes or something are not made in the book, and they are not true. I'm sure Ratner wasn't deliberately lying himself, but was talking carelessly, and there's several things that have to change there. Where the president was lying, consciously lying, was when he said over and over, there is no doubt that our intelligence has proven that. We know where these things are. When he knew, and had been told over and over, that the evidence for that was controversial, thin, weak, and so forth. That was a lie, and that's sufficient to impeach him on. To say, however, that, for example, it was said by Ratner that he said that Saddam was behind 9/11. Actually, he managed to fool the American people into believing that without ever saying that. He actually never did say that in the book. Makes that clear. What he did was simply say 9/11 and Saddam Hussein in the same sentence or paragraph over and over and over several times in one speech, giving the impression that we're going into Iraq because of 9/11, which clearly means, what else could it mean, that 9/11 was caused by Saddam. But he didn't actually say that. So that to say he said it is mistaken. We shouldn't say mistaken things. Things are not correct.
Yeah.
I'll finish with that.
Cheney,
it's another matter. Cheney kept saying over and over about the Muhammad Atta issue. I don't think that Cheney ever said, let's get on that. I don't think Cheney, but let's think Cheney for that, that's fine. If Cheney said that, but the president did not, that what Cheney did say over and over, having been told to the contrary, and is still saying it, that he believes, or it is a fact, that Mohammed Atta met with Saddam Hussein's intelligence in
Czechoslovakia.
And actually, I just read in the 1% Doctrine by Ron Susskind that the director of intelligence in CIA, Janie Mischel, a woman, told Tenet she would resign if they forced her once again, if they tried to force her to say that was true. She said it is not true on that. Of course, they did keep going and say it, but they didn't say it with the imprimatur of CIA anymore. Later, Cheney tried to get her to lie about something else, to reveal something. She said, no. And somebody Porter Goss sent a note back to her then head of the CIA and said, you can't say no to the vice president. And she said to her boss at that point, sometimes saying no to the vice president is what we get paid for. Well, she was wrong. She was fired 2 weeks later. So it was not what Portergas was paying her for. We're in a position now where what she did was not enough. Fine. What I've been saying for 2 years, and what I'm going to say now with greater urgency, it was good what she did. She refused to lie. It was not enough. Knowing that the president was lying, was the Cheney in this case was lying, Cheney, that he didn't lie. She should have said, not just, I won't lie with you. She should have said to herself, I will expose you. I will oppose this policy. I will not resign. I will tell the truth to Congress and let you fight. I will then go out with documents and I will prove that this is wrong because we're in a crisis. What the traitors who founded this country said, every one of them, a loyal subject of George III in 1774, every one of them subject to being hanged as a traitor in 1776. That's what they were referring to when they said, in pursuit of these principles, and to gain the government that's in our Constitution, ultimately, and our Bill of Rights, which lay ahead, we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And we must do no less right now. Thank you.